Who's heard of the Louvre, the museum in Paris? Have you heard of that? The Louvre is the largest museum in the world. It's also the most famous art museum in the world. 783,000 square feet. That's like over 17 football fields. And it's just all of the, you know, the great artists throughout history, Da Vinci and Monet, and you name it, they're there. Some of the most famous works of art that you'll find anywhere. Now imagine that you are one of the lucky 15,000 people who visit the Louvre every day, and you are touring there, and you notice a curious sight. Among the many tour groups that are there is a group that is all, everybody in the group is wearing dark, dark sunglasses. And they're walking around and they're stopping. And so you're listening to their conversations. And as they stand in front of these exhibits, you realize they don't even perceive correctly. By their conversations, you realize they're not understanding what they see. And you suggest, well, why don't you take off your glasses? Do you know that we have people in our culture, in fact, most people, who are visiting the world's greatest art museum every day, and they're wearing dark sunglasses, and they're squinting, and they don't understand what they see? They don't perceive correctly. I'm talking about unbelievers who experience God's creation just like we do, but do not have the worldview that allows them to perceive what they are seeing. They are blind to it. They have to be. Now, I'm not saying they don't appreciate it to any degree. They certainly do. But they don't have a way to understand it, to categorize what they're seeing. And there are consequences to that, some of which we may discuss. But we need to think correctly. We need to perceive correctly about the creation because of what it implies about our Creator. Okay? And we need to properly value the creation, understand it for what it is. Not worshiping it, not turning it into an idol, but also not neglecting it and failing to appreciate it. So this morning we're going to take off the dark sunglasses as we consider God's artwork and what Genesis has to say about God's creation. So you can turn to Genesis chapter 1. And we're going to look at, we could say more, but we're going to look at five things that we can learn about the creation from the book of Genesis. And the first thing is that creation is orderly. Creation is orderly, predictable, governed by laws, not governed by randomness, not chaotic. For example, Genesis chapter 1, verse 14, and God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. And what we see here is a hint of the order that God has made in the universe. The word separate indicates orderly distinction. The word signs points to predictability. The word govern indicates order. Do you see this? And this is all much to our benefit. I don't know if you think about that, how the many ways that we benefit from all the order in creation. This morning, it was no surprise to me that when the sun came up, it came up at 6:08 right over Rockford. I've got in my den a window that faces east, and I can watch the sun come up. It comes up right between those two trees. Orderly, predictable. I wasn't surprised. Tonight, the sun will set at 9:13. Isn't that nice? 9:13 instead of like 4:50 in the winter. 9:13 tonight. How do we know this? We know it because God put a greater light in the sky to govern the day and a lesser night to govern the night. He made an orderly universe for us. The orderly universe is an expression of God's orderly nature, but it's also an expression of his love for us. Think about it. It would not be very kind of you parents if you changed the rules for your children every day, would it? I just changed a door on the barn, and the old door used to swing like this. The new door swings like this, and I cannot get used to that. I go up and I go for my handle over here, and then I have to switch. Now, what if your parents changed the swing on your door every day, kids? So you had to relearn everything because it was always shifting. Or what if Dad went in and tinkered with the water heater every day so that one day it's freezing cold in the shower and the next day it's scalding hot? I bet your dad doesn't do that, does he? No. Good. My own kids say no. What about, how many of you get, kids, you get off school and you go and you punch in the code on the keypad for the garage? What if Dad changed that every day? That would be pretty rough. You see, the fact that God gave us an orderly universe with predictability is an expression of his love for us. Now, to say it's an orderly universe is not, I want to be clear, I'm not saying that it's just functioning on its own, and I'll say more about that in a moment. But I want you to think about that. When you think about order and predictability in the created universe, that this is something that God gave to us because he loves us. You don't have to wonder what temperature water is going to freeze. You don't have to do when chemists mix two substances together, they know what's going to happen, and they know that what they learn today will be good for tomorrow. In fact, without that, we couldn't even do science. How many of you benefit from science? Anybody? If you're wearing these, you benefit from science. If you ever go to the doctor, you benefit from science. If you drive a car, you benefit from science. Do you know that science is a gift from God? Science would not be possible without order and predictability. Now, I said a moment ago that does not, the fact that the universe is ordered does not mean that it's just off running on its own. And that's the mistake of scientific naturalism. They think that because these things are, it seems like, there's no God involved because we don't see these miracles all the time. And so God must be out of the picture. Not at all. The orderly universe is still dependent on the creator who made it. He did not walk away from it. And so don't confuse orderly and predictable with independent. Hebrews chapter 1 tells us that it was through the Son, through Jesus, that the universe was made. And then in verse 3, it says, the Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. The universe needs a creator, but the universe also needs a sustainer. And only God has power and life in himself to sustain the universe. Everything else derives power and life from God. If you jump ahead to chapter 2 of Genesis, for example, just a little picture of this. It says in verse 9, and the Lord God made all kinds of trees grow out of the ground. Trees that were pleasing to the eye and good for food. You see, he didn't just make them. Notice, he made them grow. So they didn't grow in an instant. You know, growing is a process, right? Are the trees still growing? Who's making them grow? How are they growing? Here's what Job 38 says. We'll apply this to the raven. Job 38 says, who provides food for the raven? It's a rhetorical question. Who provides food for the raven when its young cry out to God and wander about for lack of food? If the ravens are eating, it's because God is feeding them. If the trees are growing, it's because God is making them grow. If your heart is beating right now, if your lungs are working, it's because God is keeping you alive. You have a creator, but you also have a sustainer. I was in an extended dialogue one time with an atheist, and I remarked to her that if there was no God, I wouldn't have any confidence that 2 minutes from now my heart would still be beating. And she laughed. I expected her to. She's wearing dark sunglasses. How is it that that tree is pulling up water from the ground right now? Think about the powerful currents in our ocean that are powerful enough to sweep away mountains. Where are they getting their energy? Have you thought about that? How is the earth moving right now? Did you know the earth is moving at about 1,000 miles per hour, roughly? I think it's 1,040 miles per hour. Now, that's if you're on the equator. It's a little slower for us. How's that happening? Where's the energy coming from? Is it plugged in somewhere to something? The warmth from the sun. Why do you feel it right now? And you do feel it right now. Why do you feel it right now? I'm not talking about the creation moment. Do you know that if God was not sustaining you, do you know what the temperature would be in here right now if God wasn't sustaining all things by his powerful word? Anybody know? Jason, you should know this. What is it? Right, but what is it? Excellent. That's right. I even looked that up. See, he is a legitimate science teacher. Yeah. It would be negative 459 degrees in here right now, absolute zero, if God was not sustaining the universe, if Jesus was not upholding all things with his powerful word. The creation needs not only a creator, it needs a sustainer. And we need to remember that. So Genesis teaches that God's creation is orderly. It is certainly dependent. It also teaches that it is diverse. Now, when we speak about diversity in creation, we should remember that there is diversity in the Godhead, right? Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, all fully God, yet distinct. And so if there is diversity in the Godhead, we would expect that there would be diversity in the creation. Verse 11, then God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds. And it was so. Verse 14, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate day from night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years. Let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. And God said, verse 24, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. Verse 20, God said, let the water teem with living creatures, and let the birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living and moving thing with which the water teems according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Now think for a moment about how God could have chosen to create the universe, okay? Let's just hypothetically here. He didn't have to create it at all, by the way. He didn't need it. He was completely self-sufficient. So he made a choice to create a certain kind of universe. Now he could have decided to create a different kind of universe. He could have created a universe with not this kind of diversity. He could have put a single star in the sky. He could have worked that out. One single really hot star in the sky and a smaller universe. Could have done that. He put as many as 400 billion of them in our galaxy alone, the Milky Way galaxy. Now, with the naked eye on a clear night, you can see about 9,000 of those stars. Get yourself a good telescope, and you can see 15 to 20 million of them. But if you get beyond our galaxy, not physically, literally, but if you consider beyond our galaxy, there are about 170 billion other galaxies in the known universe. And we're talking about thousands upon millions upon billions upon trillions and trillions and trillions of stars. And God created them all by saying, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky with a word. He created them. Such diversity. He chose that. Furthermore, he didn't have to create all the diversity of life on earth. Think about the plant life. Think about birds. God didn't have to create all those different birds. He could have just, I'll create one bird, a sparrow. It's gray. But no, look what he created. As I was kind of looking at some of these pictures, and I was just Googling, you know, birds, and I saw this really high resolution picture of an eagle. And I was just captured by its eye. It was like this translucent yellow, and it was just fascinating to me. It just drew me in. And then I found this picture of an owl. It was really high resolution. I was zooming in and looking at the feathers and the details. Just amazing. Why? What? He didn't have to do this. Look at that parakeet. Is that evolution? Is that helping the parakeet? I need that to survive. Right? It's amazing. We should be in awe of this diversity that God chose to create. What does it tell us about God? Think of fish and other aquatic life. God could have chosen to create just one fish. The catfish. Right? The ugliest of all fish. Yeah, Jason's a bass. But he created this amazing array of beautiful, beautiful aquatic life. Why such diversity? The whole earth, once dead and dark, is now just bursting with life. Plants and trees and fruit trees and birds and butterflies and fish and colorful reptiles and mammals of all different shapes and sizes and colors and textures. Think about it. Some of them live underground. Some animals live on sides of cliffs. Some of them kind of float in the air all day long, just drifting with the clouds. Think of the diversity. Just think about I don't know if you've ever thought about the diversity of sounds in nature. Some animals moo. Some chirp out beautiful melodies. Some hum. Some click. Some howl at the moon. Some roar in the jungle. All the different sounds. Why didn't God just make one sound that every creature would make? Think of their movements. The antelope zooms at 50 miles per hour, and the tortoise creeps along. And the falcon dives to the earth at 200 miles per hour, and the sloth barely moves at all. Have you ever seen a sloth? They literally move like this. Why? Why? The dolphin spears the water, arcs through the air. The squirrel leaps from tree to tree. The monkey swings by vines. The inchworm inches along. The crab sidesteps like he's doing some kind of country line dance or something. The walrus flops around. A walrus reminds me of when I'm zipped up in my sleeping bag. It's like, how would you like to do that? How would you like to live that way? Think about it. Penguins waddle. Chipmunks just dash. They never slow down except for when they're stopped. Some creatures just float on the current. You know, you can go to the zoo and you can witness all this diversity of life. And that's good. But when you've left, know that you have not seen 1/1000th of 1% of all the diversity that God has infused in his creation. Why? What does all that diversity tell us about God? Well, maybe the obvious thing to say is that it is evidence of his indescribable wisdom and creativity. If I paint 10,000 pictures and they all look the same, I'm really not much of an artist, am I? But if I paint 10,000 pictures and they're all different and each a masterpiece and they all end up in the Louvre, then I am an artist for sure. And my name belongs in art history books. Why such diversity on earth and in the heavens? I think one of the reasons is so that you and I can marvel at it. So that you and I can be blown away by our Creator. So that we can get a sense of how awesome is the Creator of this diversity. The psalmist writes, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words to the ends of the world, not just the heavens, but the earth as well." What is that voice saying? Intuitively, we all know that the poet is greater than the poem. We know that the composer is greater than the symphony, right? We know that the chef is greater than the meal. The cookies out there this morning, who made those cookies, by the way? I've got to know, the chocolate chip ones with the nuts in them, who made it? Okay, Wendy, if you could bring like a half a dozen of those every week just for me, that would be as great as those are, and they are delicious. And don't eat any of them because I licked them all. But I didn't really. I had two and I almost went for a third and I thought, you know what, that would be gluttonous, so I'm not going to. But as great as they are, the chef is greater. We know that, right? Intuitively, the building is greater, or the builder is greater than the building. The inventor is greater than the invention. And we know intuitively that as awesome as this creation is, the creator is greater than the creation. So it's good to be in awe of God's beautiful and diverse creation because it leads us into a greater sense of awe for our God. O Lord, my God, when I in awesome wonder consider all the worlds thy hands have made, I see the stars, I hear the rolling thunder, thy power throughout the universe displayed. When through the woods and forest glades I wander and hear the birds sing sweetly in the trees, when I look down from lofty mountain grandeur and hear the brook and feel the gentle breeze, then sings my soul, my Savior, God, to thee, how great thou art. Seeing the art, we see a glimpse of the artist. And we say how wonderful, how awesome, how majestic, how brilliant is our Creator. And I think we also have to say, how comparatively small are we, right? I think the awesome diversity and creativity in God's world gives us a good sense of smallness. Okay, we have dignity, but it humbles us. And it shows us that there's never a place for pride in our hearts. The creation is orderly. The creation is diverse. The creation is blessed. This one is easy to miss in Genesis, but don't miss it. Verse 21, chapter 1. So God created the great creatures of the sea, every living and moving thing, every winged bird. And God blessed them, verse 22, and said, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the water in the seas and let the birds increase on the earth." And we see the same blessing given after the creation of man. God blessed mankind and said, "Be fruitful and increase." So God's blessing, God's favor has been poured out on his creation. We call it grace. And lest anyone think that, well, now we live under the curse, so the blessing is gone, consider that man and beast are still multiplying. And as long as there is a God, and as long as there is a creation, there is blessing. The creation is orderly. It is diverse. The creation is blessed. The creation is under dominion. It is under the dominion of man. Verse 26, then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. You hear a lot about animal rights. In fact, somebody, to play a practical joke on my son, signed him up to receive text messages from PETA. And so he's giving me reports from time to time. Dad, they're riding elephants at the circus. We've got to stop this. And you hear this kind of thing from the animal rights crowd, right? Everything is a grave injustice against the animal world. Zoos and circuses are terrible. We milk those poor cows and we make butter for our pancakes, and it's awful. And they're having the Iditarod race, and they're harnessing these sleds to these dogs. And actually, the dogs love it, but hey. And the Amish, think about, you know, they're hooking up their horses and they're plowing the ground, and it's just terrible, we're told. Let me clear something up. If you look there in chapter 1, you see that phrase in verse 26, let them rule over fish of the sea, birds of the air, livestock. The Hebrew word radah, translated rule over here in the NIV, is literally, according to Strong's Old Testament Dictionary, literally it means to tread down or to subjugate. Now, I think that it's probably moderated in this use, but you see how strong of a word that is. Now, obviously, it doesn't mean to abuse or to be cruel or to act irresponsibly. In fact, in Proverbs chapter 12, we're told that a righteous man cares for the needs of his animals. Okay? And yet, we are to take dominion. We are to rule over not just the fish and the birds and the animals, but the whole earth. The whole earth. The creation still belongs to God. We are mere stewards, right? We have no right to abuse it, but we are to take dominion over those things, those parts of creation that are not made in God's image. And the reason that there's confusion on this is because people are out of touch with God's created order. They don't understand Genesis, or they're just simply in rebellion against it. And don't get me wrong, if the animal rights people have something that is really an abuse or something that's genuinely cruel or brings unnecessary pain, we ought to be the first to join them and say that this isn't right, because it is God's world. It is his creation, and we are to be stewards. And let me talk more broadly for a moment about environmentalism, because this is everywhere, right? This is the eco you know, the eco craze is everywhere you go. How do we think properly about that? You know, if you think about it, it's interesting that most of the environmentalist movement today has no foundation for what they are saying we need to do. They're saying we need to care for the earth, we need to preserve the earth. And yet, rejecting God, they don't have a basis, they don't have a moral foundation. So if you don't have a moral foundation, you don't have objective moral rights and wrongs, do you? You can't. And if you don't have objective moral rights and wrongs, everything is relative. And they even say that. And so if it's all relative, then I don't have any duties. I have no moral duties. So they're saying, you should recycle, you should do all these things, you shouldn't use certain products, you know, and yet they're imposing their what they would admit is just an opinion. We actually have a moral foundation. We should be leading the way on this. We should be environmentalists in a sense, but not extreme environmentalists. You know what I mean by extreme environmentalists? The people who say that you don't eat meat, you don't use any animal products, you don't pull oil out of the ground, you don't cut down trees, right? And they have the bumper sticker. I don't know if you've seen it. I don't know what Indian it is. I'm sorry, Native American. But it's like a picture of Chief somebody, Bucking Bison or whoever. And it says, the earth doesn't belong to us. We belong to the earth. No, that's not what Genesis says. We belong to God. And so does the earth. It's His. He created it. And so if He's the creator, who gets to say what happens to the earth? God, right? And He gave it to us to steward. So let's think properly about creation. Let's think properly about environmentalism. Okay? God lent it to us for our stewardship and for our pleasure. Okay? Hang on to that because we're going to talk more about that. The creation is orderly, it is diverse, it is blessed, it's under the dominion of man. And finally, and most importantly, the creation is good. Have you ever made something and you ask somebody, well, I want your opinion of this. I want your evaluation. What do you think? Good? Not good? God evaluated His own job performance here in verse 4, verse 10, verse 12, verse 18. In case you're missing these, verse 21, to make sure you're catching it, verse 25. He keeps saying over and over and over, it was good. God saw that it was good. Now, that's not bragging. That is a perfect, flawless, objective evaluation of His handiwork. And in verse 31, referring to the totality of His work, He says it is very good. The Hebrew word tov, used to indicate beauty, favorability, loveliness, wealth, and bounty. It's good. The creation is good. And if God says something is good, it's good. If He says something is right, it's right. You know, people today say, well, there is no objective good. There's no objective beauty. There's no objective truth. No, there is. We live in a fallen world. It's harder to get to it. A lot of opinions floating around. And if we're going to get to the objective good, we've got to get outside of ourselves and see things from God's perspective. And thankfully, He reveals Himself to us and reveals all of this to us so that we can see and understand. And so when God says it's good, we can know something. It's good. Some people will say, well, that was before the fall. I've heard this. God said it was good, but then it fell, so it's no longer good. Is creation no longer good? Here's what it says in Romans 8, New Testament teaching on this. It says, the creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Now, if it's groaning, it knows something's wrong, but there's enough there to say that there's something still right. And if God is liberating it from the bondage to decay, then there's still something there to liberate. You see, this tells us that the creation is still good. It's in bondage to decay, for sure. But if there is a decaying process, and that process is not over, then there's something left of it. The tomato might be bruised on one side, but it's still good. And of course, not everyone agrees that the creation is good. One of the most influential men ever to live, referring to the philosopher Plato, said the creation is not good. Plato saw birds and trees, and he saw reptiles and animals and beasts of the earth. And he said, it is not good. It is not good. Don't kid yourself if you think, well, that was then. Plato is still around. Platonism is still alive and kicking. And unfortunately, there are some Christians who are more guilty of Platonism than the world. What we call Neoplatonism or Christoplatonism, this idea of negation, it's a bad thing. So I want to separate it myself from it. I think it was Schaeffer who told this story about encountering some man in a rose garden, and it was just beautiful roses everywhere around. He says, well, look at the lovely roses. And the man, a very pious Christian, said, I am not of roses. I am not of this world. I don't care about roses. Well, those are God's roses. So we should care about roses. I'm not saying you all have to, you know, be crazy about roses. But he was reflecting an attitude. It's a misunderstanding sometimes of the verse in John says, do not love the world or anything of the world. It's talking about the rebellious world. It's not talking about the creation itself. Here's what Paul writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy 4. If we want to understand this, he writes, the Spirit clearly says that in latter times, some will abandon the faith and follow deceiving spirits and things taught by demons. Wow, what do demons teach? Such teachings come through hypocritical liars whose consciences have been seared as with a hot iron. Wow, what is this going to be? Is it going to be like homosexuality or something? What? This is going to be bad. Verse 3, they forbid people to marry and order them to abstain from certain foods. This is the principle of negation that infects the church sometimes, where we say, don't do that. If you abstain from that, then you're holy. You're better. I'm not talking about sin. I'm talking about created things. They forbid people to marry and order them to abstain from certain foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and who know the truth. Why did God create them? What's the purpose? That we would receive them with thanksgiving. For everything, verse 4, for everything God created is good. And nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving, because it is consecrated by the word of God in prayer. And obviously, he's not talking about sin. He's talking about things that God made for us. The belief that what God made is no longer good, Paul says that's no small error. Paul actually says that is something that is taught by demons. The New Testament consistently teaches that God's creation is still good. James chapter 1, don't be deceived, my dear brothers. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights. If you have good gifts, they're from God. If they are from God, they are good. And not just the physical creation itself, but the created order. And I'm talking about how things were designed to operate in God's creation. The order is still good. The design is still good. In Mark chapter 10, it says, some Pharisees came to Jesus, tested him, asking, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? What did Moses command you? He replied. They said, Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and send her away. It was because your hearts were hard that Moses wrote you this law, Jesus replied. But at the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Where does he go? He goes back to the beginning. The order is still good. He says, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. They are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God joined together, let man not separate. So in laying out the rules, Jesus goes back to the created order, the way things were intended and designed to operate. It's still good. It's still in effect. It hasn't changed. So don't fall for Platonism, this idea that physical things are bad or evil. Don't fall for asceticism. You know what asceticism is? We've talked about this before. Anybody know what asceticism is? You remember that word? It's the denial of pleasure. It's the idea that pleasure itself is evil. There have actually been people throughout church history who have taught that sex within marriage is a bad thing because it's pleasurable. That's asceticism. That is error. Paul addressed it directly in Colossians. Since you died with Christ to the basic principles of this world, why, as though you still belong to it, do you submit to its rules? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. These are all designed to perish with use because they are based on human commands and teachings. Such regulations indeed have the appearance of wisdom, but they don't work. Don't fall for asceticism. God is not the kind of God who says, here's what I want from my creation, my people. I want them to be miserable. I don't want them to enjoy life. I don't want them to find pleasure in anything. I want them to eat bland foods, and I created the world in black and white. That's not your God. Asceticism is false. Now, why do people do that? Why do they reject God's creation in that way? Do you know what the motive generally is? It's to show how spiritual they are. It's to show that I can deny myself of something that God has given me and other people can't. It's to show how spiritual they are. You want to show how spiritual you are? Here's how you do it. Enjoy God's good creation that He gave you. Enjoy it in faith and with thanksgiving. That's spirituality. With thanksgiving, the same way Jesus did it, right? What did Jesus do? When he ate, he always gave thanks. He ate food. He drank wine. Do we know that? And he did more, apparently, than nibble and sip, right? You know the scripture from Luke 7, the Son of Man came eating and drinking. And you say, here is a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Okay, so did Jesus actually get drunk? No. Was he actually a glutton? No. But he at least ate and drank enough that they could get away with leveling that charge at him. And if Jesus is our model, think about this now. If Jesus is our model, if he's our example, and he ate and he drank, then asceticism is wrong. It's actually an abuse of God's creation. It's a neglect. The creation is orderly, it's diverse, it's blessed, it's under the dominion of man, and it is good. The creation is good. We need to have that biblical foundation, that biblical understanding of God's creation. Now, I want to prepare some of you young people for an objection to our God, to Christianity based on creation that you'll probably encounter if you go off to college. The college professor will say to you, well, you've got a problem. Because God made everything that exists, and evil is something that exists. Therefore, part of God's creation is evil. God made evil, and therefore, God cannot be good. God created everything that exists. That's your major premise. Your minor premise is that evil is something that exists. And the conclusion, therefore, God created evil. God cannot be good. Well, what do we say to that? Once again, we have to return to Genesis. I think that's where we start as God's people. Did he create evil? Is that what it says? Was evil part of the original creation? Does it say, and God said, let there be hatred and war and violence and bloodshed and rape and theft. And God saw that it was good. Is that what it says? Do we see evil here in the original creation? No, God is not responsible for it. It's not there. Well, what about that professor's argument? Because it does seem rather airtight, doesn't it? God created everything that exists. And we would say, yes, the Bible says that. That God created everything that exists. Evil is something that exists. Not so fast. Is evil something that exists? Well, actually, Evil is what philosophers call a privation. You know what a privation is? It's an absence of something. It's like dark. Dark is actually not a thing that exists. Did you know that? Darkness? Darkness is simply a lack of light. Cold. We talked about cold earlier. Cold is not something that actually exists. It's not a thing. It is merely the absence of heat. Some have used the illustration a donut hole. A donut hole is not something that actually exists. It's just the absence of what goes in there. And you can buy them, right? They take them out and they put them in this box. Before that, before somebody said, let's market these things, I assume the donut makers ate them. But a donut hole is not an actual thing that exists. It's a privation. Evil is a privation. Yes, God made everything that exists, but evil is not, technically speaking, it is not a thing that exists. What God made was only that which conforms to his character. And we say that we define good as that which conforms to God's good nature. Well, why would God create something that contradicts his good nature? He not only would he not do that, he couldn't do that. And so God is not responsible for evil. Think about it this way. Imagine a home that is under construction. And right before the owners get ready to occupy, vandals break into the home and they put holes in the walls and smash the windows. And the homeowner comes in and he says to the builder, "Did you build this entire house?" "Yeah." "Then you are responsible for these holes in my windows and my walls." Right? "No, the holes are not actual things. And they are not in the blueprint." Evil was not in the blueprint. Now, well, why is it there? It's there because God values relationship. And we need to have freedom to make choices in order for love to be meaningful. God has to give his creation that ability. If love is to be meaningful. And we are the vandals. We're the ones who poked holes in the walls. Okay? So evil is not a thing. Evil is real. Evil exists, but it is not a thing. And it certainly doesn't need a divine architect to explain its existence. I want to make a couple quick applications to what we have learned about God's creation. It's simply this. Appreciate it and enjoy it. Marvel at it and enjoy it. Under certain conditions, it can be an act of worship to take a walk through the woods. Under certain conditions. Now, don't mistake what I'm saying. I had a guy tell me one time, "Well, my church is in the woods." Like, no, your church is not in the woods. Unless your whole church family meets in the woods. But your church is not in the woods, okay? God calls all of us to be in a relationship with the body of Christ. And so we could meet in the woods, but if you're going off in the woods, somebody said, "My church is on a horseback. You know, I'm just riding along." No. But that can be an act of worship. It certainly can. You worship God in a bass boat, Jay. All right, thumbs up. Growing a garden can be an act of worship. Staring up at the starry heavens can be an act of worship. Sitting on a shore and watching the waves come in can be an act of worship. Sitting around a campfire, listening to the crickets chirp, that can be an act of worship under certain conditions. And the conditions are these. Understand the creation properly. Know that it is from God, that it does not exist on its own. Realize that it is his grace coming down to us, the Father of the heavenly lights. Realize where it's coming from. Don't value it above God himself. Receive it in faith and with thanksgiving. And it's an act of worship. Our whole lives are supposed to be worship. So enjoy God's creation. Appreciate God's creation. It's good. Sir Edward Burne-Jones was a prominent 19th century English artist. And a story is told of him going to his daughter's house for a tea. And that is pretty much all the English do, is they sit around and drink tea, as you know. So he went to his daughter's home for tea. And during the visit, his young granddaughter misbehaved. So her mother made her stand in the corner and face the wall. Now, what do grandparents do when this sort of thing happens? Right? Well, Sir Edward restrained himself, as grandfathers must do, and he did not attempt to intervene on his granddaughter's behalf, even though he would have liked to. So the next day, he arrived at her house with his paints, and he went to the wall where the little girl stood the day before, and he painted a colorful mural that would delight any child. A kitten chasing its tail, lambs playing in the pasture, goldfish swimming. If his granddaughter must stand in the corner from time to time, at least she would have something to look at. Judgment is tempered by grace. That's the world that we live in. It's good. It's cursed. It's fallen. Yes, there are thorns, but it's good. Judgment is tempered by grace, and we have brought these things on ourselves, and God has brought us His grace. There's much good, and God wishes in the midst of the curse for us to enjoy His good creation with thanksgiving. Now, there is a maker, but there is also a remaker. And there is a creator, but there is also a recreator. Talking about the same God. That's the point of the gospel. God, through Jesus Christ, is making all things new. Revelation 21:5. He who was seated on the throne said, I am making everything new. Everything. There's a maker and there's a remaker. And the question is, are you made new? Are you being made new? There will be a new heaven. There will be a new earth. It will be better than ever. God will dwell with His people. We actually sang about it this morning. Those who have received forgiveness and reconciliation, those who have experienced new birth, those who are new creatures will experience this new creation with our God forever. And in the meantime, may the present creation, good yet groaning, may it cause us to long for that permanent and perfect creation that God is preparing.